Session number 4891, Reel 3.
User or cameraman, Jim Wright, Reel 3.
Yes, the Prince of Wales was a very helpful fellow. He invited me on one occasion to accompany the party, the royal party, with himself, the Duke of Kent, when they went to Norway at one time, and take a cameraman along to film whatever was going. Whenever we had the Prince of Wales to film at any time, Cave Chin was our cameraman, because he knew Cave Chin extremely well. In fact, he never forgot his name. He always used to name him. How are you, Cave Chin? What are you going to do today? What are you going to do with me now? Well, if a man remembers things like that, he can't be far wrong, you know. I think Prince Wales is a very, very good chap, really. Misunderstood in some respects.
Did you do many overseas trips?
Oh, quite a number. We, in the early days, I took a sound truck all the way from Stockholm right through Holland, filming, this is before Movie Town started, filming making of Edam cheese, the shrimping at Vandam, the diamond business in Amsterdam. We went into Belgium. I forget what we did there. We went into France and filmed a beauty contest. This is long before Movie Town started. This is in the early, very early days. Then worked our way into Spain.
Which company was this then?
Movie Town. That's when I was Movie Town. Down to Spain, then over into North Africa, where we were looking for everything with sound. This was all purely an exploratory trip, roaming around Europe, trying to cover sound, to get pictures with sound. And we're really working direct for New York then, at that time. Because the Movie Town setup had not been organized by that time, but I had already with the company, and I was, you know, working alongside them, doing all this experimental work before the company actually started. And we went into North Africa and filmed the Arabs on their Arab stallions, chasing across the desert, firing their guns, the usual Arab picture that you see every now and again. And that was all made very good sound. And then we were shipped up into Italy to do an interview with Mussolini in English. He couldn't speak a word of English.
Can you recall that occasion?
Yes, quite easy. Cameraman said Ben Miggins was the man, an American. He said, well, how the hell are we going to get this fella to speak English? And he doesn't speak a word of English. I said, simple. I'll run around to the English school here in Rome and get hold of one of the speakers and a blackboard and easel, and we'll write the whole speech out. We'll get his speech in Italian, and then I'll get this teacher to transpose it into phonetic English. And the first interview in sound with Mussolini was done that way by an English teacher in Rome writing out his speech on the blackboard phonetically, and he was reading it, looking there with two eyes like saucers, and we got Mussolini. That's when he was considered to be quite a wonderful man, not the beast that he turned out to be. But
was he very pleased to be filmed by a British or an American company?
I don't think he knew or cared, as long as he got publicity. Then when I was in Movie Town, we were breaking fresh ground all the time. I was the first man to film George Bernard Shaw. I wanted to show you that the papers, and I got those already out today. Must have left them at home. We had Rudyard Kipling.
Him to appear before the camera?
Many times. Very charming man, George Bernard Shaw. Loved publicity. Loved the camera. And his early Movie Town picture is quite a joy to look at. The BBC put it on the other day. However, we tried to get Rudyard Kipling. I met him, and he was very charming, he was very interested, but he would not appear in front of the camera. We
That's
had a go.
Surprising, but he was very interested in the cinema.
Yes, but he wouldn't go. He wouldn't appear in front of the camera. I've got a letter. As a matter of fact, my daughter-in-law's got the letter now, saying, "No, thank you." I gave her the letter the other day. Because it happens to be a copy of his signature. I said, "One day you'll be able to sell it and make a bit of bread," as they call it. Then we did Lloyd George. There's another man, charming Welshman. I always think the Welsh is a bit funny, but he was a very nice man, and he invited us down to his place, Chequers, I think it's called. Chequers is the other one. Chequers is the Prime Minister's residence. A very wonderful house there, and I remember his lunch very much. Even now I can remember the lunch. We had a glorious lunch, and he said, "Gentlemen," he said, "do you realise that everything on the table today was grown on this farm?" And that was all. I thought it was very nice.
Who attended this lunch?
Myself, a cameraman, sound engineer, and one pressman. He invited us up to Crickets on one occasion, up in Wales, to do an interview up there with him. I, through him, got to know Megan Lloyd-George rather well. In fact, in the early days, in the very, very early days, I really got around and met most people worth meeting and recorded them on film.
Did you record the other politicians who were actually in power at that time?
We did a very fine picture on the very first one that was ever done of the entire British cabinet on the terrace outside number 10 at the back. If you look at the back of number 10, have you ever been in number 10?
No, I haven't.
Well, the back of the cabinet room leads out onto a terrace. Open up the French doors and you go right onto the terrace. Well, we had Ramsay MacDonald. And we got him to agree to let us make a picture of him on the terrace at number 10.
Was it difficult to persuade him?
No. He invited me up to Lossiemouth on a couple of occasions, to his little cottage up in Lossiemouth. Unfortunately, that always meant travelling on New Year's Eve, going through the night, because he always wanted to see me on New Year's Day, or there near New Year's Day.
In order to record a message?
Well, how that started, that sort of friendship started, was he was when he became Prime Minister during the period that I was making pictures, I used to know his secretary, Rose Rosenberg, rather well. Very nice secretary. And I phoned Rose Rosenberg. I said, "Could we do a picture? Could we make an interview with the Prime Minister? First day of his office." She said, "Oh, well, I'll ask him. If he says yes, you'll have to do it up at Hampstead." He was living, he had a house at Hampstead. The answer came back, "Yes, be up there 8 o'clock tomorrow morning and he'll make an interview." So I got there in time to have a boiled egg with him. And after breakfast, we made a very nice interview with him. And that was that. That was Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister of England. First day of office.
He was then interviewer. Most of the speeches, the politicians talking to the camera in those days, they just address the camera rather than
didn't answer questions. We would give them a gist of what we would like them to say, and then say, "Now it's up to you. You say whatever you like, and we'll take whatever you say."
But you would indicate to them what you wanted them.
Well, as near as possible. We would, usually it was some subject we wanted to talk about. That was all. What can you ask a man to say on his first day as office of Prime Minister? What can you ask? You can't ask him what he's to say what he thinks he's going to do. Just simply a message to the people, that's all. Now, I can't remember all these things. God bless my soul, it was a good many years ago. A lot of water's gone under London Bridge since then.
Do you recall election broadcasts?
No. They were made, of course, but I can't remember them. And then we paid an awful lot of attention to that sort of thing. It's never regarded as good news. Very controversial, isn't it?
Statements by...
I know, but you remember, once again, I'll go back to the fact that we were making pictures for a cinema audience. We avoided politics as much as possible. Because you please one, you offend somebody else. Our job was to entertain. We weren't in there to please politically one party, displease another party. We were in the entertainment business. And we never forgot that for 1 minute. We never dealt with politics, and we left religion alone. We'd show pictures of the Pope, of course. We'd show all the business that they show now, the black smoke and the white smoke and the crowds and the Pope addressing the multitude. Certainly, why not? The Pope's a very fine man. Whoever the Pope is a very fine man. Say, we would show the Archbishop of Canterbury. And one of our first pictures in sound with movie tone was the chap banging his staff on the door, on the west door of Canterbury Cathedral, crying to be let in. Do you know the one? A standard picture. Well, that was all done in sound for the first time. But no, we were in the entertainment business.
But there were certain news events in the period which also did have a political significance, for instance.
Oh, well, of course. I mean, you had the Mosley riots, you had all those sort of things, but we left them alone. When I say left them alone, we didn't emphasize them, we didn't harp on it the way television harps on it. I mean, look what you see on the screen today. You've got cameramen behind the people with the hoods on in Belfast today. We would never have allowed that. If our cameramen any of our cameramen had done a thing like that in my day, they would have been fired out of hand. I'm appalled to think that cameramen will do that sort of thing. Showing young children, throwing bottles of petrol at soldiers. Who are not doing any harm, they're only trying to keep the peace. And yet they've been shot and murdered right, left and centre. And they've got cameramen there who are taking pictures of it. They would love to get a picture of a man being shot. But so far they haven't been there at the right time. The RIA haven't told them we're going to shoot somebody. Now we'd like to bring a cameraman along. But they're organising this bottle throwing and Molotov cocktail business. You've seen it on the screen.
Yes, I have.
Well... Don't you think that's disgraceful?
Well, it's organised largely for the cameras in many instances, I think.
Maybe it is, but the cameramen are not worthy of the name who will film that sort of thing and call it news. It only inflames trouble. All this damn business in Southwark, or wherever it is, Lambeth Way. I mean, disgraceful stuff that's going on. Now, I know who's organising it, don't worry, so does the government. But that's not my job. Worry about that now, thank God.
To return to the 1930s, when Mosley announced the march through the East End, this was clearly going to be...
We had an interview with Mosley on one occasion, rather sorry we ever did it, because we weren't quite sure what he was up to. We did an interview with Mosley, I admit that. But I don't think that's the thing that we would like to boast about. I don't think much of Mosley.
But...
I oughtn't say things like that on tape, but nevertheless, it's true.
There was surely a difference there between simply doing an interview with him, which could just remain in the can, and actually deciding to show it, which was your responsibility was to actually provide the coverage.
My responsibility was to get news,
yes.
And decent news, news that you could show the family.
Yes.
I was not in the business to get news which was abhorrent to anybody. As I go back again to this entertainment business. We were making a newsreel for the entertainment of all ages, young and old. you can't mess about with politics and all this other rubbish that's going on today. We're not looking for circulation figures. Trying to sell copies.
Did you consider that the other newsreel companies had exactly the same attitude to controversial events?
Oh yes, I'm sure they did. I know they did. You see, the people who were running the other newsreels, Sir Gordon Craig of Movie Town, Carlton Knight of Come On British, Jeeps of Universal, and Bear of Pathé. They were a different breed of men than what you've got in the news game today. I mean, they just... they knew the business they were in. They were not in the business for stirring up the trouble. You see, editors today know that if they can stir up trouble, they sell copies. And I don't agree with that. I mean, look at the things they're doing now. Take this murder trial at the present moment. Checkbook journalism, it was called. I think I can't describe it better than that. Don't think it's... they're not worthy of the name editors and news editors that do things like that. Any idiot can go, if he's got enough money, can go and buy anything within reason.
How did you provide for overseas coverage?
Well, we had associations with all the major newsreels throughout the world. Actualités Françaises in Paris, newsreel in Italy, Novo something in Madrid, one in Japan, one in South Africa. Wherever there was an established newsreel operating in the world, we had an arrangement with them. There were also quite a large number of freelance cameramen all over the world who were available to take pictures. We had one man in Malta, very good man. Another man in Cyprus, very good man. We got men even as far south as Tierra del Fuego, most southerly part of South America, and people in what is loosely called Darkest Africa. We knew a big game hunter there. He was a very good cameraman. If there was anything happening in his district, we'd get him along, he'd cover it. He had a very good news sense he had. So we always got coverage, and the way we got coverage very quickly is to watch ticker machines on the office, dishing out the news as it happens. As soon as something happens that we thought was worthwhile or newsworthy, I'd send off a cable straight away to nearest cameraman to the spot and request coverage as soon as possible, and which meant that we'd get the thing within about 24 hours, especially when flying services improved. And in the early days, we got film very quickly because quite a lot of the aircraft captains would bring the film personally. You could hand the film, you can't do it now, but in the early days, you could hand a can of film to the captain of aircraft and say, you'll be met at Heathrow, or you'll be met in New York, or you'll be met somewhere. Somebody will come and collect the film from you. And that's exactly how we used to work. Of course, all news film is duty-free. There's no duty on them. I organised that with a very charming lady named Mrs. White from the Foreign Office in the Finance Bill many years ago. Got that passed through the Finance Act at the very last minute, so that there's no problem in the transshipment of news film anywhere, because there's no duty on film, on news film. So he's not held up by customs at all.
Was the film ever stopped from leaving the country?
No, not to my knowledge.
There was film of the riots in Paris in February 1934, which was delayed. The French government asked for that not to be shown.
I didn't know. 1934. I don't remember that.
This was rioting in the streets by right wing.
My God, they're always having rioting in Paris. Almost any time I go to which Paris, there was a riot going on somewhere. But
you can't ever remember any problems.
I cannot remember that at all. I'm not denying that it didn't happen, but I don't remember it. I on my word of honour, I don't remember it.
But normally the provision of news from overseas was entirely unhindered.
To the best of my knowledge and belief, I cannot recall any stoppage of news in my lifetime. I really can't.
There was also the assassination of the King of Yugoslavia.
We had that exclusive. That was filmed by Paramount cameraman. I used to know his name, but I've forgotten it now. But that, they never stopped that. That came over, we had that. It's been shown quite recently. So far, I've been talking about newsreels from 1928, but one shouldn't lose sight of the fact that silent newsreels existed many years before that. For instance, Pathé Gazette and Gaumont News in particular, but Pathé, I think, longer than most. Newsreels, however, really came to life with the advent of added sound. Although Pathé had already experimented from time to time with gramophone discs, which they tried to synchronize with the picture. It wasn't very successful, but it was a step in the right direction. It was Fox Movietone in America that started the real new idea of newsreels with sound with the invention of the Fox Case Light tube, which linked up with microphone and amplifier caused striations of light on the side of the film. Later on, Gaumont British News produced the variable density system. And from then on, of course, various sound systems were devised by the other companies, and the newsreel business with sound was really and truly launched from that time on.
You yourself, though, were the pioneer of the first sound newsreel in Britain.
Yes, because before British Movietone News was started, I had been asked if I would take charge of the sound truck which had come over from America with an American cameraman named Charles Davis and a sound engineer named John Phillips. To take them around the British Isles and the continent and film anything and everything which appealed to me as either news or a good picture amplified with sound, or improved with sound, I think is the correct word. And I did that for quite a considerable time until, of course, they decided that it was time to start up British Movietone News in England as an entire British company, which was done in later time in conjunction with the Daily Mail, with their great news gathering sources. And British Movietone News was launched. This, of course, started all the other newsreels on the same trend. Pictures with sound became very, very popular. In fact, perhaps one of the most popular items of the cinema entertainment, I'm happy to say. And I still think that we had a very important role to play in the cinema. And I think the results speak for themselves.
How much material did you film specifically for the parent company, or did you not do that? I mean, most of your coverage was for inclusion in the British newsreel, but
But being the offshoot of an American company, presumably you would sometimes hope to have your British material.
No, I think you misunderstood what I said. I worked for Fox Movie Town News with an American crew in England purely on an experimental basis.
No, I understand that, but I'm talking about...
But when British Movie Town News started, I joined British Movie Town News as a British company entirely.
Yes.
With, of course, American associations, like any other company. It was a complete British company, and I started off as its first editor. But which I told you in a previous talk, I relinquished that to Gerald Sanger, and I became the production manager because you couldn't have two editors of one newsroom.
You described at our last meeting how you obtained foreign material from other newsreels. How did your...
Oh, I see what you mean. I'm sorry, when you said other newsreels, I didn't understand that. Oh, yes. Well,
did you provide or make available film material to, say, the American or the French or the Spanish newsreel companies?
We had a rather unique exchange arrangement in that we agreed to exchange British news for foreign news at our request. Now, they didn't want everything that we shot in England, neither did we want everything that was shot in France or Germany or elsewhere. But we certainly wanted the news items, and with our arrangement, with our friendships and associations throughout the world, we had a free exchange of news. I'm thinking now, I don't know what other companies did, but I was thinking about Movietone, and later with Paramount. Paramount had the same arrangement. We had a complete free exchange of news.
But only with certain companies in these other countries?
With the companies that we could have arrangements with. You couldn't have arrangements with all the companies. I mean, each country, there are several newsreels in France. Well, our arrangement was Acteur Office Francais. Pathé would have had their arrangements with Pathé of France. A Movietone would have had their arrangement because they'd already set up a newsreel, a Movietone in France, French Movietone, or Movietone Francais, or whatever it was called, I don't know, and so on and so forth. But there were many other companies that were available to all of us, to whom we could apply for news, coverage of anything. I mean, we could even... I used to ask Acteur Office Francais to cover special things for us, which they were possibly not even going to cover, which they did gladly. There's no charge made for it. They might ask us to cover something very special that they wanted from us. We would cover it in return. It was a quid pro quo arrangement.
Entirely free of charge.
Entirely free of charge. I don't think the present system, which I think has been set up of paying so much a foot, is very restrictive. I don't agree with that. I think there should be a free exchange of news everywhere.
Did you have any arrangements with the Soviet Union for the exchange of films?
Yes, we did. Not until many years later. Not until many years later. As a matter of fact, it was almost... I think it was after the war. It was before the war. It was before the war. We did have an exchange because there were certain things happening in Russia that we wanted to get coverage. I suppose the Russians wanted something from us. So we arranged a meeting with the Soviet authorities, not only ourselves, but I think a man named Innes. I remember rightly, if my memory takes me back that far, he was an Australian or a New Zealander working for the BBC. He was in on the meeting, and we had a meeting at the Newsreel Association with the heads of the various newsreels, plus the BBC, where we agreed with the Soviet authorities, the film authorities, that we could exchange selected items of news. I mean, we were anxious to increase the world's knowledge of news, whether it was Russian or we wanted them to show our items in Russia
And you recall this as having been before the Second World War?
Oh, yes, no, it was before the Second World War. Of course it was. So wait a minute. I'm sorry, I can't remember now. I really can't. Are you asking me to go back? I think it was, but I'm not quite sure. Wait a minute. Now, I think it was after the Second World War. It wasn't before the war. It was after. Yes, quite definite. I'm definite on that point now. It's very difficult to go back 30, 40 years or more and suddenly remember everything precisely. I'm doing my best.
You're doing very well. At our last meeting, you mentioned that you were not in the battle for circulation figures in the 1930s, and you contrasted that with the news media today. But what, therefore, was the impetus behind trying to make your newsreel the very best? Did you assume that you had a static audience? Or did you hope to attract the audience away from other newsreels at the various cinemas where you...
I suppose that was the underlying thought.